Welcome back, everybody. Our next discussion is on technology and democracy. So the many permutations of public participation, law, and technology, from people participating in the process of making law about technology to laws that govern surveillance of democratic activists and other permutations that you can imagine. So I'm just going to quickly ask our speakers to introduce themselves and then present their work and thought in these areas, and then we're going to have a wide-ranging discussion. And a couple of logistical matters for the discussion are the Twitter hashtag for this day of events is CyberLaw12, which I have the feed up here right now. And then we also have something called the question, through which you can submit questions and comments, upvote the ones that you would like to see addressed by the speakers. And to do that, go to the URL here, cyber.law.harvard.edu/questions/cyberlaw12. So feel free to submit those at any time, and we'll keep an eye on them. So without further ado, Rob?
Oh, I start. Great. Can you go up there? Does that work?
Sure. Although, just briefly introduce.
Just introduce who you are.
Right. And then we'll get to that next.
Rob Farris, I'm the research director at the Berkman Center.
My name is Mark Stanley. I work at the Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington, D.C. We work on internet and technology policy and legislation.
My name is Cade Crockford. I work for the ACLU here in Massachusetts. I do all privacy and government surveillance work.
My name is Matt Wormer. I'm listed as being from Occupy Boston. That doesn't mean I'm representing Occupy Boston, just relaying my experience here. My day job is I work at the World Wide Web Consortium.
Great, thanks. So, Mark, you're welcome to stay here or take the podium.
I'll just stay here if that's okay. I want to talk about three legislative and policy developments over the course of the last year and that are also coming up that have been pretty impactful. And the first, of course, is SOPA and Protect IP. But specifically, I wanted to talk about the work of a handful of technologists on SOAP and Protect IP, specifically Paul Vixie, Steve Crocker, Dan Kaminsky, and how what they did really had an impact on defeating that legislation. And briefly, the technologists wrote a white paper that really spelled out the effects that DNS filtering would have on DNSSEC. And that was followed by articles, a letter by Sandia National Labs, which of course is a huge national laboratory under the Department of Energy, as well as Stuart Baker, a former high-level official at the Department of Homeland Security under George W. Bush. And back in December, when I think one of the key points of when that legislation really imploded was the House markup of the bill. And what happened was you had a lot of congressmen, including Representative Jason Chaffetz, Republican of Utah, point to this white paper that these technologists had done, and also juxtapose that with comments that were being made by members of Congress saying that they didn't really know what DNS was or how it worked, and saying basically, I mean, he said it in kind of a derogatory way, but he said, you know, we need to have the nerds in here. We need to be hearing from the technologists, the engineers that actually understand how this works. And he was basically implying that many members of Congress were on a level three or even level four level of cluelessness that Ed Felton was just talking about. But that had that was very politically impactful. And without the work of those technologists, I don't know if SOPA and Protect IP would have died as swiftly as they did. The next bill that I want to talk about is CISPA, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. And I think post-SOPA, a lot of the same advocates and internet users that spoke out against SOPA, they also spoke out against CISPA. And now, CISPA wasn't killed outright like those two IP bills, but there have been significant changes to those bills. And I think it kind of shows the growing impact of this sort of new internet advocacy and activism movement. Congress is really paying attention. We're not going to kill every bill outright, but there's a new sort of political clout that internet users and internet activists have when it comes to internet policy matters. The third issue is the at the end of this year, the ITU, which is it's the International Telecommunication Union, they are going to be having, and they're a special agency with the UN, they're going to be having a meeting, and countries like China and Russia are pushing for the ITU to have more regulatory power over the internet. And this is really going to take, and this is going to affect the sort of lightweight, decentralized, multi-stakeholder governance of the internet that's really allowed it to flourish. So that's going to take a sort of global activism movement to derail this sort of UN centralized takeover of internet governance. So these are the big policy matters that my organization, CDT, is really looking at. And what I want to say real briefly is that I've just come from two different conferences that are quite different from this gathering, Netroots Nation and Personal Democracy Forum. And these two conferences are more—they're more geared toward activists and startup people that do startups, and really the dominant theme has been how are we going to capitalize on the internet's new political power, and a lot of people are really excited that they have a lot of big ideas, but I'm here to say that going forward, as part of this new movement. Technologists and programmers, they really need to be involved for two very important reasons. First off, a lot of the internet advocates and grassroots people and even people who do startups, they don't have the level of expertise that people in this room have, and they really need to hear from folks here and benefit from that expertise. They can't afford not to. Second, I think that technologists, engineers, programmers, I think that if they speak up, I think they're on policy matters. I think that their voices are going to be heard. People from Congress will listen. I think that the voices and perspectives of people in this room carry a lot of weight on Capitol Hill if they speak up. So, with that, I will. Is it Kate next?
Rob next.
Oh, Rob next.
Does that work there?
I believe it does.
Okay. Hi all. Can you hear me? Okay. Great. So. Coming from the Berkman Center, I am a sociologist, not a lawyer, not a technologist. I'm going to talk about civic engagement online. We've done, along with colleagues at the Berkman Center and other institutions, done a lot of research around the world on the recent events around the world over the couple years. It's been a wonderful time to be a researcher to study civic engagement. I have 3 points I want to make. Maybe it's only 2.5. We can count after I'm done. The first one is a lot of internet policy and advocacy is devoted to making sure that the avenues for information flow are maintained and open. That's certainly crucial. It's a big part of online organizing, but the aspect which I think is underemphasized is the tools and the ability to organize online that has, in many respects, a greater impact. We could talk more about that. Second point is that in looking at case studies, looking at the events in the Arab Spring, looking at Russia, looking at SOPA PIPA, it became very evident that the roots of this have been a very long time in coming, that anyone saying that there was this kind of this flash mobby thing going on with mass mobilization is wrong. That in every single one of those events in the Arab Spring, we can see the roots of that uprising in the bloggers and in the blogosphere many, many years back, perhaps a decade ago. Same thing in Russia. Many of the leaders of the protest movement there made a name within in the blogosphere and the networks that they leveraged there came from that. So that's point number two. Point number three is, of course, that wider adoption is an essential part of this. So at some point, you need to get the word out to a wider audience, be it through being picked up in mass media was the old way to go about it. Facebook is a new mode of going about it. Another way of going about it is to repurpose existing communities. In many senses, in not only in the Arab Spring, but in Russia and in SOPA PIPAs, we see that communities were formed around one area of interest, took on another cause and organized through that. So be wary of the librarians and the knitters and the gamers. So what this means in a sense is that we've
talked about three theories of change using digital tools. One is the champions, the leader model, the Crockers and Vixies of the world, or the leaders of the Arab Spring movement. Another theory is that it's in the network, that it's this core of several dozen or perhaps 100 people that have been working and debating and deliberating these issues over time. The third issue is that it's the internet and the ability to publish and reach a wide variety of people via Facebook or Twitter or other tools that's really the telling case. Well, the conclusion we're coming to is that it's all of the above, and you need to put all three of these together if you're going to pull something off. You need the champions, you need the network, and you need the wider adoption for it to come out. Returning to the first point again, in terms of policy and regulation, we'll hear in other sessions later in the day of the efforts around the world to restrict content online and suppress community formation. But communities are much more fragile than information. It's a lot easier to get an idea out and propagate that meme. Communities themselves are much more fragile and harder to understand. And so those are some of the things we're working on.
Everybody, I'm going to say some things that are a real bummer, just to warn you all. That's pretty much always my role, so here it is. I'm doing it again. So I agree. Open communication is pretty much the most important thing that the internet offers us, right? Unfortunately, the legal landscape that we live in now, we don't even have to worry about CISPA or SOPA or the next bad thing. I mean, it's a nightmare legally right now in this country, and I'm specifically talking about surveillance law. Not so much just, you know, censorship, but censorship through the back door, which is surveillance. You know, people cannot communicate openly online if they're afraid that the government's listening to them. It's called chilling, right? We remember COINTELPRO. It's happening again. So I'm going to talk very briefly about the series of laws or policies that have been enacted over the past 10 years since 9/11 that have created a real legal nightmare. I mean, I really wish that the FTC technologist was still here, because I'd really like to hear what he has to say about this. I mean, he mentioned helping the government, sometimes law enforcement, get access to, you know, information on computer networks that they couldn't get. And, you know, I'm curious, did he get a warrant? I mean, did he see a warrant? Because often they don't, unfortunately. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the legal framework, and then I'm also going to say a couple things about how programmers and technologists can help us fight this stuff. Because if we want the internet to be free, fighting censorship is not enough. We have to fight government surveillance. And unfortunately, it's not just Russia, it's not just Iran, it's not just Syria. It's happening here in a really bad way. So I'm sure many of you know about NSA, sort of vacuum style, you know, whole-scale surveillance. Basically, they get anything they can get their hands on. So, I mean, that's, you know, the highest level of government surveillance there. Many of you have probably heard whistleblowers such as Thomas Drake and Bill Binney, who used to work for the agency, talking about how, you know, the NSA retains copies of every American's emails, text messages, phone communications, etc. They're building this giant data center in Utah right now. Obviously, they're not reading all of our emails, but, I mean, the potential is for mass retroactive government surveillance. So, you know, you're cool now. You know, who knows who's going to be president in 20 years? The NSA is still going to have your communications from 5 years ago. So that's one huge problem. And then, of course, you know, when questioned about this in Congress, General Keith Alexander, head of the NSA, says, I don't know what you're talking about. We don't even have the capability to do that. Right. So that's sort of the highest level. But then there are a number of other, you know, levels beneath that. For example, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, passed in 1986. Anybody guess how old I am? I won't be offended. I was 3 years old when ECPA was passed. I was three, right? Cell phones were this big, the size of bricks. The internet practically didn't exist. Nobody used email. This is the state of electronic communications privacy law that is governing the FBI's access to our communications right now. It's pathetic, frankly. So, you know, and then there are a whole series of issues within ECPA as it stands that are really problematic. For example, a federal magistrate judge just released a really interesting report just last week talking about how he estimates that about 30,000 what are called Section D 2703 orders under ECPA are issued every year.
These orders are not warrants. This should be very clear. They're not warrants. They're not exactly subpoenas. They're orders that are issued after ex parte, judicial proceedings, which for those of you who are not lawyers, means that, the government, the prosecution goes to a magistrate behind closed doors and says, this is why we want this order. Here's the information to back up our case. The target of the subpoena never sees it, never has a chance to defend it. And oftentimes, if you're never actually charged with a crime based on the information that they were surveilling you about, you'll never know that the government was reading your emails. You will never know. So we're facing a huge problem, a crisis with ECPA. FISA warrants, even. Just this week, there's been huge news on FISA. Senators Ron Wyden and Mark Udall, pretty much the only people on the Senate Intelligence Committee who seem to care about our privacy, keep banging down the door saying, look, there's a massive loophole in FISA, which we think allows the government to surveil U.S. to U.S. communications without warrants. What are we doing about this? They basically are told to shut up. Nobody cares. And this is it's a problem throughout Congress, the executive branch, and the judiciary. Really, we're facing an onslaught from all three branches of government. Section 215 of the Patriot Act is another great example. This is something that still exists, almost 10 years later. Raise your hand if you do not hate the Patriot Act. Seriously, no one in this country likes the Patriot Act, and it's still law. I mean, it's frankly shocking, the level of undemocratic, legislation that has been going on in the past 10 years in this country. Nobody likes the Patriot Act, and we still live under this regime of secret surveillance and secret orders. So that's a lot of really bad news. There's one more piece that I actually want to tell you about because you probably don't know. Many of you probably knew about that other stuff. But one piece of the Patriot Act that's particularly disturbing is called it authorizes the FBI to submit things that are called national security letters. And these are secret subpoenas that they can send to, telecommunications providers. Not only that, but to doctors, therapists, banks, any organization that holds your third-party private information. The FBI can just write these secret subpoenas and actually gag people. So, we had a client at the ACLU a number of years ago, Nick Merrill, who ran an ISP and received one of these for his clients, and he didn't want to obey the subpoena. So, he risked jail time by coming to the ACLU and saying, I've received this subpoena. I don't want to conform with it. I want to fight it. We ended up fighting it. He's not in jail, thank God. But not everybody who receives one of these things can hire the ACLU or, get the ACLU to defend them in court. So I'll just, and one more thing about that is that now we have these state-level secret administrative subpoenas. So it's not simply, the FBI who's doing this, but here in Massachusetts and in many other states, we have what are called administrative subpoenas, which are basically the same thing. I mean, they don't come with a gag order, but, they all say at the bottom, please do not disclose the existence of the subpoena to the target. And let me tell you, AT&T is not making, its business plan off of informing you when they receive a subpoena for your content. They don't care. Twitter is the only company thus far that has really stepped up to the plate in a public way. They're now defending Malcolm Harris, an Occupy Wall Street participant whose information was subpoenaed by a New York State district attorney. So anyway, what can you do? This is all a lot of really bad news. I'm here to tell you that as programmers, you have a responsibility, actually. You have an ethical responsibility within this legal climate, which is a disaster, to actually retain as little information as possible about your clients. Because anything that you retain is, subject to be seized by, either a national security letter, an administrative subpoena, even if it's a FISA warrant, in many cases, as Ron Wyden has warned us, it's certainly possible that these FISA warrants are being, or rather that the communications of American citizens are being sucked up through FISA warrants that are directed at people outside of the U.S. So, again, there are a number of ways in which the government is getting access to communication that's held by third-party providers. So if you run any kind of web service or if you're developing programming, please keep that in mind. No logs, right? I mean, Twitter's a great company, but they actually don't, as far as I know, for their business model, need to retain all the information they do. Why do they need to, know my GPS coordinates every time I look at Twitter on my phone? I don't see why that's relevant to their business model. They shouldn't do it. So yeah, there's that. And then please, you know, help us join the ACLU, join, you know, support CDT, support EFF, and, you know, help us by writing papers on this stuff. You guys are experts. You know probably a lot more than we do. And give us money. Thank you.
I'm just going to stay down here. So I've been trying to figure out what my 5 minutes were going to be. And every time somebody else has spoken, I've kind of torn up what I was going to say and started over. So I just have this random collection of notes now. If you're not familiar with Occupy Boston, first of all, it was a camp that started in late September, ran through December, was eventually raided by the police and taken away. You've all heard of Occupy Wall Street and all this sort of stuff. My role in this was I was one of the first people to try to help with the Occupy Boston internet technology, information technology stuff. So we started OBIT, you know, Occupy Boston IT. And it really became this microcosm of kind of all the problems we're hearing about here today. You know, the time everybody who launched the movement, launched the camp, you know, used whatever tool they could, whether it was Google Groups or Gmail or Facebook or whatever, to try to, you know, set up and maintain this movement online, make a, you know, have an online presence. There wasn't a whole lot of organization to it. There was a lot of cluelessness. There was a lot of cluefulness. There was a lot of, you know, all of the different levels that were discussed today we went through. And we were, you know, had various legitimate disagreements about what level of transparency we should be having. Should we even worry about Google's tracking us when we're not doing anything really wrong and want everything to be out in the public anyway? So we argued for quite a bit, decided upon, no, we're going to sort of move away from the tools that are being used by regular people, and we're going to commit to open source at this particular ISP that's, you know, committed to resisting subpoenas and things. So we moved our infrastructure off of, you know, sorry to call it infrastructure, it's really just wrong, but we moved our collection of randomness from, you know, these tools and into our own set of tools. And we had, you know, every problem that, you know, Mr. Felton talked about. You know, we had expert level decision makers, we had people who didn't have a clue, we had you know, we had some people who didn't who had experts that they didn't know weren't good experts. We had a whole range of things, and on top of that we had this consensus process where nothing can really be done without, you know, a majority of people agreeing. And so we went through, you know, a long, hard slog trying to recreate all of these things that we had done. And it was not easy, to say the least. But one of the advantages we had is that Occupy is very much, you know, embodies sort of the hacker ethic. And if you didn't like it, you could kind of just throw it away and start over. That was like a legitimate thing to do. And you don't get that in, say, government working on policy. I'm sort of less scared, I think, of the internet going away because I have my faith in sort of hackers who, you know, they just want to hack and they just want to write code. If the internet goes away tomorrow, we'll build something else. It'll get done. You know, Paul Vixie, you know, can't write a letter every time, you know, there's a new law. And hope that he can also, you know, keep writing code and getting stuff done. So I don't know. I have a little bit more faith. I don't really think anything as drastic as that is going to happen. But yeah, I guess that's all I really wanted to say.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Really interesting. I have one question that I think could be addressed by any of you, or hopefully all of you, which is, Sherwin mentioned this morning, even if we get some kind of consensus on a panel in this room, on the street, there are people with billions and billions of dollars who are going to disagree. And part of the narrative of what happened with SOPA and PIPA is that it was Google's lobbying won, as opposed to people power, 12 million people contacting Congress, et cetera. So is the people power of the internet really dependent on an alliance with some existing big money that has a lobbying organization in Washington. If so, what does that mean for efforts to reform the Patriot Act to enhance people's privacy, where it's not clear what the commercial interest is in allying there? So anyone who wants to take that up, please do.
Sure, and what did you say? Was it do you think it's possible? Yeah. Well, I think with SOPA, that was an easy thing to say. This was Google, and it was a sort of easy scapegoat. And we saw Google; they were scapegoated from the very beginning, from the first hearings on SOPA. So that was the sort of line of attack. But if you go back to November of last year, that was American Censorship Day. It was a ad hoc thing that was created by a really cool group called Fight for the Future. Sort of one of these young sort of startup grassroots groups. But that kicked things off, and there was millions of people that participated through that. And then in December, you had the markup, which I mentioned earlier, which basically the bill is the House version of a filibuster. The House can't filibuster like the Senate, but they basically held up the markup, and the bill couldn't pass out a markup. Google actually didn't come on board and do their petition or their blackout logo until January. So there was already a lot of progress that had been made. I also think going back to what's happened with CISPA, companies like Facebook, they've been pro CISPA. Google certainly didn't come out against CISPA, but yet substantial privacy changes were made to the bill in the House, and now on the Senate cybersecurity side, substantial privacy changes are going to be made to whatever comes out of the Senate bill. So we can't kill internet users, we can't expect to kill every bill, every bad bill. We can't expect to kill it outright. But I think that they've taken note of, I think Congress is basically looking over the shoulders now and saying, you know, how will the internet react to this? But we also have a responsibility, I think, to kind of capitalize on that and say what's next, and maybe even do something, have a positive agenda instead of always saying no to bad things.
And just very briefly, I know that in terms of driving traffic and interest from the public, Wikipedia probably did tons more of that because they actually blocked out their entire site as opposed to just having a logo change. And Wikipedia isn't rolling in dough.
Be happy to pile on that. It's hard to draw lessons from SOPA PIPA that are applicable to other topics going forward. I mean, we just don't know. There are a number of things that are unusual in this. One is that the internet almost uniformly came down against it, and I don't know how often that's going to happen. I don't know if the other thing is that it captured the imagination of the internet, and I don't know how often you can say this bill is going to kill the internet and we really need to rally around this. I think you can do that several times, but you probably can't do it every year or every other year. And so really, really hard to gauge where this goes moving forward. I think there's certainly an unbelievable power in this movement. And I think that I completely agree with you that the seeds were sown and the argument was won well before Google jumped into the fight in January. I think that people are overselling the role of Google in that. I also agree that Wikipedia played a larger role than Google in that. But how to apply that to future debates? I think the jury's out on that. I have no idea.
The people who want it aren't going anywhere, right? I mean, the people that like these laws and want these laws in place, you know, are their opinions going to change? No. They're just going to keep coming and, you know, fractured into smaller places, and another bills, and I don't know. We'll have to find a way to react as we go.
Yep. So certainly their influence is diminished. It's not as strong as it was before.
And Mark, I want to thank you for putting Sherwin on the spot and making this discussion a little more democratic. And anyone who wants to come up to the microphone to ask a question or make a comment, please do so, and please also use the question tool. So Matt, one thing you mentioned was putting together the IT for Occupy Boston was rejecting the commercially available options and going to open source. I'm curious what the specific motivations for that were. It was it the kind of thing that Cade was talking about in terms of data retention? And what does that mean for the market space for these services? So is there a market in offering services with greater privacy, or is open source the communal self-defense mechanism people need to use to get that?
Well, that's a good question. So at the beginning, we couldn't even really describe to the movement itself why we needed to do these things, right? Google Docs, it's great, we can share, it's out there, it's open, you know, let's put our plans for, I don't know, some march, you know, out there in this Google Doc, and, you know, maybe some guy will sign in and say, hey, let's start throwing, you know, fire extinguishers through windows. And I'm like, oh, we don't want that. But we also don't know whether Google will, you know, point out that, hey, this guy, you know, when they get subpoenaed, hey, this guy, you know, wasn't part of the movement, whatever. We don't know what's going to happen. So our motivation was to get things on our own servers where we at least felt we had a modicum of control. Everything was, you know, on encrypted disks, and we had this protection of this ISP, who actually was just recently tested. They had a subpoena served for them for forgetting the name of the university. I think it might have been in Ohio, where an anonymous remailer had been used to mail in bomb threats.
Oh, Rise Up.
Yeah. So this had been going on for weeks, and the university was having to evacuate buildings on a regular basis. And this anonymous remailer was hosted at you know, the ISP we chose. And eventually the FBI came in and took it away. They shouldn't really have any success getting much off it, we hope, since the disks were encrypted. So we'll see.
Can I say something? That's a really good example of a terrible decision that an ISP provider made. You know, they should rise up. So the organization that he's talking about is called Rise Up May 1st. And if you Google them, you'll find that Rise Up May 1st runs an email server and a web hosting service for a number of radical left movements and organizations and people. So for them to host an anonymizing re-emailer service is really dumb, because that is bait for the FBI. And what the FBI did was come in and take physically all of their servers. So now everyone who ever had an email account with Rise Up, everyone who, you know, hosted their services through Rise Up now is, you know, has their information is now held by the FBI. So that's one great example of a really piss poor decision that people made. You know, people who frankly are really thoughtful about this stuff and, you know, dedicate their entire careers towards, you know, tech liberation. That was a bad idea.
There is a level of abstraction between Rise Up and May 1st itself. So May 1st being the ISP, and so our stuff wasn't compromised at all. The other people that would use this Rise Up organization, yeah. You know, we tried also in the IT group not to do stupid things, right? Which, you know, a lot of the people in the IT group were there to be a part of the protest in a information technology kind of way. You know, they wanted to kind of go out and do hacktivism and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, we had to try to keep the infrastructure up and running without, you know, without the infrastructure being implied in any of this stuff that was may or may not have been going on that I may or may not know anything about. which it was a real challenge, but it was a lot of fun. But I think the open source movement it really made a huge difference in how Occupy ran. Being able to just take our own instance of MediaWiki, the software that Wikipedia runs on, and knowing that, you know, everybody knows how to use this. People, you know, can support themselves, basically. That was a huge win for us. Same with WordPress. Email wasn't so simple. Turns out, you know, our email infrastructure in open source is still a giant pile of code from the 70s and 80s that really is just awful. But yeah, open source really saved our ass, put it simply.
So we have access in this room to a lot of technological expertise that we as lawyers or sociologists may not often have. So I want to ask the panelists, is there something in specific that you would like to hear from the audience about, drawing on their expertise?
Yeah, I have a question. I mean, in your experience, do you feel like programmers and technologists really know or care about the government's interest in people's private communications? Does that seem like an issue that's relevant to people in your field? And if it's not, how can we make it relevant, I guess, is my second question.
And we can throw out additional questions, and people who are interested in addressing any of them are welcome to.
Yeah, well, we need law reform. I mean, that's one thing for sure. But the only reason that I said that is because, in an anonymizing email service, unlike a project like Tor, which anonymizes your IP address, is inviting this kind of juvenile illegal activity. And so, I think that, it was irresponsible for an organization that, holds a lot of information about people who are obviously targets of government repression and surveillance to engage in that kind of activity. And they didn't run it, they hosted it, I should say.
Sort of interesting to see there too. There's this anonymous service running on this machine that does multiple things, handle multiple services for RiseUp. And the FBI, for once, seemed to be kind of clueful. They didn't come in and take an entire rack, or whatever had any mention of the word RiseUp on it. They came in and kind of surgically took out just what they needed. But we were terrified. We didn't know that they were going to do that. Were they going to take out, throw the switch on the whole building? Let's go through this. Suddenly, we were wondering, is this action of these people we don't even know going to result in the movement's infrastructure being taken down? Should we have then used Google Groups, which is distributed and backs up, has all these backups and things? And I was like, did we make the wrong decision?
Well, so that's one of the really interesting things about this, right? Like, I frequently think about this when the issue of Tor comes up, because Tor is sort of like waving your hand to the NSA and being like, hey, I'm an activist, or I don't want you guys to read my, email or find out where I live, which is really troublesome, obviously, right? I mean, we should be able to use anonymizing services without worrying about it raising a red flag. But in some ways, if you're just an average Joe and you're going about your life, using Google might actually be safer because, the government is not interested necessarily in looking at every single person's Gmail account. But, the use of an anonymizing IP service like Tor can raise red flags for them, which is so paradoxical and unfortunate, but unfortunately is the case.
So you're asked whether technologists in general are aware of some problems. And I think, looking at my own students, I would say yes.
So when that question was asked, I actually wrote a note to Matt that said my aunt supports the Patriot Act, my aunt in Texas. So no offense, but there are people out there that support it. But I think one of the challenges as far as getting, you talked about your students, but you know, just getting anybody to care about these issues is how we articulate them and how we connect these issues so that people connect with them viscerally, or they see how they impact their everyday lives, you know, how they impact the tools that they use. And so I think it's great that Matt's here. He has actual experience, considering these things. But when we talk about ECPA reform or surveillance and, you know, throughout terms like 2703D orders, as soon as you throw out a term like that, you don't lose people in this room necessarily, but a big portion of the public, all of a sudden, you lose them. You know, they don't know what terms like that mean. And I think if you're able to, I'm hopeful that if you can articulate these issues well in a way that people can really connect to them, and basically you can get across the point that the government can access your email without a warrant, without going to a judge. Without respecting your Fourth Amendment rights. If you can get that point across, I think more people will care, but a lot of times it's hard to articulate sort of complex legal and technical matters to the general public.
Yeah, I'm realizing now, I disagree. I don't think people will care that their email's being written. Yeah, I'd love it if the NSA wrote my email, that would be nice. I think, you know, until you disrupt them buying shoes and Amazon, this is what you do, right? You say your entire, you know, pornography surfing history is going to be made available. Then maybe they'll
start
to care.
That's how they got the Supreme Court to care. It is.
Well, you know, it's interesting, though, because you have different, you have Tea Party organizers, and then you have Occupy Wall Street. And if you talk about cell phone tracking, for example, the ability of the government to track your movements without a warrant, because again, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, written in 1986, it didn't foresee the precision with which, you know, you could be tracked by your cell phone, so that protection wasn't written into it. I don't know, but I do agree with you, until people actually feel a direct harm, it is sometimes hard to get them to care. I think with SOPA, as people thought that the websites that they like to go to every day, there's a chance that they could get shut down. And that's what motivated them. I'm sorry, do you have a question? I kept talking too long.
Well, I just want to push back against that, actually, because we've done some pretty extensive focus group polling type stuff that shows that people really do care that the government is reading their emails, and that they could read their emails without a warrant, that really is, that's actually the number one issue that people from left to right, men, women, old, young, regardless of, you know, income, whatever, people are outraged about that. And so, yeah, obviously, you know, we might unfortunately have more success. People might care more if they think that, you know, the local police department has access to their web browsing history. But it's, I mean, you know, those are different ways of basically spinning the same problem, right? So, yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Mark, that, you know, talking about, you know, Section D, 2703 ECPA orders in public is not a great messaging campaign, and it's not something I do. But I figured, you know, I'd give you all a little bit more detailed background about what's going on, because, you know, you're involved in this stuff in a more intimate way than you know, the general public. But for sure, the message should be always, do you think the government should be able to read your email without a warrant? And pretty much universally, the answer is no. And again, I am going to also push back against the notion that most people support the Patriot Act, because most people do not support the Patriot Act. And, you know, a few people do, obviously, but, you know, from the left to the right, it is a unifying message that people do not support the denigration of the Fourth Amendment. It's just, it's, you know, it's fundamentally anti-American, and I think majorities of Americans see that. So the problem is, right, how is it that it's still a law? And I don't have the answer to that question. That's a really tricky question.
Just to be clear, I'm not in favor of the government reading anybody's email, and I was sort of playing devil's advocate there. So I wonder if you ask those same people, though, that, you know, if you have this widespread of computer-using people who are told, hey, the government's going to read your email, do you like that or not? I imagine the vast majority say no. But when you throw in, like, hey, if we can, you know, stop terrorism by reading your email, then what do they say? Well, my email's not all that important. You know, I don't care. When I never say anything bad in my email, and I imagine the numbers start to dwindle, right?
Yeah, totally, and that's why it's my job to tell you that that's a really bad idea, because, you know, it's pretty clear to us at the ACLU and likely to many people in this room as well that you actually can't have a functional democracy without privacy. And, you know, the notion that anything that the government does to invade our privacy is justifiable based on the sort of ephemeral and never-ending threat of, oh my God, terrorism is really, I think, speaks more to the state of our cultural crisis right now than it does really anything else. It's a sad statement in my view, because what are we protecting actually? Is it our flesh only? So, you know, in the arguments that I make about in response to that, you know, there are sort of two main questions that I deal with a lot. One is, why should I care? And the second is, you know, this actually protects me, therefore I support it. And to the second point, I would just say, you know, take that to its logical conclusion, and why don't you just ask the FBI to install a surveillance camera at your front door and in your bedroom and in your bathroom, and while you're at it, why don't you ask the FBI to install a GPS RFID chip under your skin so that everywhere you go, you know, the FBI will know exactly where you are, they can protect you, you know. Frankly, why do you have curtains? You know what? Don't actually protect your email with a password, because you don't need privacy. You know what? So anybody in this room who thinks that they don't need privacy should just come up after here, give me your banking information, your email password. I'd love to take it. I'd be happy to share it with the FBI and anybody else. It's just facile. You know, it's frankly false that people don't care about their privacy. It's frankly false that, you know, that we can give up all of our liberty in exchange will receive security. These are false, you know, paradigms that the government has been pushing on us ever since 9/11. And, you know, I think as, you know, educated people who deal in these issues, it's our responsibility to push back against those notions.
So, Paul, I completely agree with your point. I'm sort of looking around, and there are a lot of people sort of amused at your rant there, because I hear a lot of people objecting to that exact rant, that there's a big difference between, say, the FBI getting a notice when I search for, you know, hydrazine and MD-80 versus putting a camera in my bedroom. And I found that a lot of that is actually sort of regional. You know, I spent a long time at Jeff's Hippie Crunchy Granola Institution, and there are a lot of students there that were a lot more progressive, and now I'm at a more conservative institution, and a lot of people wouldn't necessarily say that the Patriot Act is a bad thing. You're standing there saying everyone thinks the Patriot Act is a bad
thing. No, I said I think most people do.
Okay, well, a lot of the people that I know, even in computer science, disagree with that, and so figuring out a way to convince those people without resorting to the argument that, well, if you accept this, then the next thing you know, the FBI is going to install a camera in your drain plug, I think is really important. The other question I had is just a little bit more practical. You said that people should only keep as much data as they need. How much is legally required? If I run a web service, how much data do I actually need to keep? When can I delete it?
Well, to your second question, that is actually swimming through through Congress right now. You know, there was recently a law a statute proposed that would have required internet service providers to retain all IP logons for 180 days. That hasn't passed. as of yet. So, you know, I guess it depends on what information precisely you're talking about. But, you know, for example, Twitter is not required to keep logs of every time somebody logs on to their website. So there are a number of things that companies, I mean, a whole lot of things that companies retain that they don't have to. And to your first point, I mean, I agree with you. You know, I'm being hyperbolic to make a point. But, you know, it's very difficult to argue why privacy is important for people, because privacy is something that people only realize is important to them once it's gone. Privacy is intimately related to human dignity, right? I mean, we are all wearing clothes right now, right? Because we don't want to show each other our naked bodies because we're strangers. That is an issue of privacy. You wouldn't realize it unless I was sitting up here naked or I told you that you had to take your clothes off. Again, you only realize that it's gone or that it matters when it's gone, right? So, you know, the hyperbolic examples might seem extreme, and they are, but it's not actually, you know, it's not like human beings have not done these things before. And I would point you in the direction of the East German Stasi for actually a really good example, not of simply where this country's heading, but actually where the government is pretty much already at. You know, the government's See Something, Say Something program is basically a neighborhood snitch project, right? Which says, you know, be suspicious of everyone around you, don't trust your neighbors, report anything suspicious to the government. This kind of mentality is fundamentally anti-democratic. And, you know, I would love to go head-to-head with anybody who disagrees with that. Unfortunately, again, you know, most people will never concede that, or many people have a difficult time conceding that privacy is an inherent value until it's gone. I mean, even Justice Brennan famously wrote, right, privacy is the right to be left alone. It's a negative value. So it's very difficult to explain to people who sort of don't get it immediately why it is so valuable. But yeah, I share, you know, I hear you. I think the most effective way to get that message across is to build alliances with different groups of people who share your views and to make, you know, to build power from those alliances. Because frankly, you know, there are fascists in every society. You know, I'm not going to be convincing the fascists ever, no matter what I say, right? But, you know, there are people on the right, on the extreme right, like the Cato Institute, libertarians, you know, many members of the Tea Party who really bristle at the notion that the government should be able to read your email without a warrant. Those people are our allies, you know, and we better realize it and we better build power with them, because there is actually a broad-based constituency for privacy in this country. It's just that, you know, economic crises and other small matters having to do with war and peace sometimes get in the way. It's not the most popular issue in Congress as a result.
I'm curious if anyone else would like to address how to persuade people on the fence or people in the middle. Mark?
Well, I think shouting louder, I think, is actually can be detrimental. And that's for obvious reasons. There's a lot of people that did a lot of shouting on SOPA. Some, I mean, there was misinformation on both sides, admittedly. And it's, you know, unfortunately, when you do talk about privacy issues, a lot of times it feels almost like you have to shout and you have to be hyperbolic to get your point across. For example, CISPA, the bill I talked about earlier, my organization, Center for Democracy and Technology, we happen to think that an information sharing bill, something that allows companies to share cybersecurity threat information more easily with one another and with the government, we think it's a good idea. So does Dan Kaminsky and Stuart Baker, two of the technologists that I mentioned earlier. But being able to come up with reasonable privacy safeguards without saying outright that you have to kill every bill that negatively impacts privacy, or you have to kill outright every bill that negatively impacts free speech. I mean, there's times where, you know, these bills, that they address legitimate concerns, and we have to be able to work with some nuance. And I think that comes down to education and awareness among internet users about certain principles about certain internet openness and freedom principles that are important. We need to educate them about those principles, and that way, when these issues do arise, they can mobilize more easily. But like I said earlier, I think there's this sort of new internet advocacy movement that's burgeoning. But I think that technologists and programmers, I think they need to be a part of that, and they need to help shape the direction that goes in, right alongside the grassroots groups and the startups and the traditional civil society groups. So I think that if folks in this room, if they care about internet users' rights, they care about policy matters, finding a way to be more engaged in that policy making process is vitally important.
I'm fascinated by this debate. I kind of appreciate both sides of it. I think shouting can be productive in some ways, and that it brings the field over to the side. But one of the things that is very vexing about this is it's very difficult to come up with a simple slogan that articulates what a good deal would be between privacy and the needs for, or at least the benefits of governments pursuing criminals and keeping the nation safe. And I think that to say that anonymous speech is great, I'm a firm proponent of anonymous speech, but the deal is never going to be made that the government will never have access to people's electronic records. I think that's a deal breaker right there. And so we're left in cutting a very thin line in describing under what circumstances our government's allowed to gather data about us, and how do we articulate that in a way that a lot of people can sign off on. And that doesn't strike me as the thing that social movements are made of.
Sure.
It's also not the thing that our government, our elected representatives, are going to do a very good job of negotiating either. And so we're left with not a lot of great options. Another one is to have the private sector offer mechanisms that do this for us. So how do we engender more Twitter type behavior and less kind of a free for all of sharing data? That's hard to pull off as well, because where individuals do value privacy, they don't seem to value it that highly in the marketplace. I mean, we're not seeing those market mechanisms really making any difference there. So I think there's room for improvement, but it's not going
to
be easy.
I actually really want to push back against the first thing you said, which is that it's very difficult to figure out a way to balance the security and liberty interests. It's not. It's actually, the framework under which law enforcement operated for many years before 9/11, which is simply that there needs to be reasonable suspicion or probable cause that a crime has been committed in order to invade someone's privacy, period. That's it. The ACLU is not asking, we're not demanding that the government never read anyone's email ever again, or never, electronically spy on someone. It's very simple. We're saying we want a return to the probable cause, or even a reasonable suspicion standard. We want the government to get a warrant. It's not complicated, pretending that it's complicated, I think, cedes the government a lot of territory. It cedes a lot of territory to the government. Mike German is a former FBI agent who infiltrated white nationalist movements. He now works for the ACLU as privacy counsel in DC. He says this all the time, and it's so true, and most people don't realize this, but the reasonable suspicion and probable cause standard for FBI surveillance was instituted not only to protect people's privacy, but also to make them more effective FBI agents. Why? Okay, there are how many people in this room right now? 30 of us? 40 of us? If the FBI is going to follow all of us around, they're not going to be very effective at finding criminals. They'd be much better off in, going after one of us who they have reasonable suspicion or probable cause to believe is engaged in criminal activity. And unfortunately, that trend has been completely reversed. So that now, the FBI's internal guidelines do not require any reasonable suspicion or probable cause that someone has committed a crime in order to spy on them. So, I don't think it's that complicated, actually. I think it's relatively simple.
So I half agree with you. So I agree with the premise that we should return to probable cause. I'm in complete support of that. I think articulating that and creating enough widespread support for that, I think that is complicated. I think that the ground
definitively shifted politically at September 11th. And I don't know if we can scrape back that easily and communicate to people that easily that this is a better standard than the newfound standard, which is let's use all available means to keep the motherland safe. So
right. No, I agree with you that it's not going to be easy to get it back. I'm just saying that it's not actually a tricky balance to work out.
One last comment.
Okay. Well, the last comment?
Yeah, you've got the last word.
Oh, wow. well, I agree with, I think privacy is, I think it is, I think it is a very complicated thing on a certain level. On another level, it's not. I mean, certain privacy rights are basic and fundamental and should be respected. I think it is hard to build a social movement, though, off of sort of nuanced questions about, ECPA reform and FISA. What I think is not quite so difficult, and what I think is going to happen within the next month or so, is there's a number of internet organizations, including Public Knowledge, including the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Mozilla Foundation, on down the line, that are going to be working on some basic internet freedom principles. And I think if we can get those out there and get support for those, and show policymakers and companies that, you know, internet users support these principles, I think you kind of go from there. And then when you come up against these nuanced questions, you know, you that'll kind of be a benchmark. But anyways, the organizations that I just named, CDT, EFF, PK, Free Press, I encourage everybody in this room to kind of follow within the next month or so, because this declaration of principles hopefully will come out, and hopefully it can be a galvanizing force to continue the momentum that we've had with SOPA, with ACTA and CISPA, to continue to advocate successfully for internet users' freedoms and rights.
Thanks. I hate to cut this discussion short, but I know everyone has been hungry ever since Ed Felton's restaurant metaphor earlier this morning. and the truth is that we're going to be continuing to discuss these issues this afternoon. We're going to be talking about cybersecurity and civil rights, so the conversation is not over, but thank you all for teeing it up so well.
Thank you.